If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Truth and Movies. Today, Mountains Made Apart, Zha Zhangke's Mandarin but not Meandarin, epic of Chinese past, present and future. Brick, the Rian Johnson teen noir breakthrough, not the Anchorman spin-off you've been praying for. And, oh yes, The Last Jedi, Star Wars saga gets reanimated. Enough chat, let's get to it. Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hey listeners, thanks for joining us on this low-key edition featuring one or two films that happen to have hit the circuit this week. We've got Michael Leader in. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Special disappointing sci-fi correspondent.
Well, will that change this time?
I don't know. Also in, David Jenkins, known for his eclectic takes on mainstream popular culture things. And so it's going to be fascinating to hear what you made of The Last Jedi, which you and I saw on opposite sides of an IMAX screening.
Yeah.
You know, to preserve the you know, to keep our impressions as pure as possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mm. You know, you sometimes sit next to people in the cinema. I mean, I've had this experience before.
Yeah.
And you see them, like, sighing, and you see them, like, looking at their watch, and
particularly,
you know,
if it's your partner.
Crossing your legs. Yeah, and it can have an effect. If someone sat next to you irritated throughout a film, it can... Yeah, draw your mind away from the action.
Absolutely. All right, we'll be hearing your thoughts, were they irritated or otherwise, on The Last Jedi very shortly. Just got to mention, though, Michael, first of all, that people can get in touch. That email address, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, the Twitter handle, @LWLies, and the Facebook page. People who have got in touch, Stefan, who takes issue with Adam, claiming that Bruce Willis's decline kicked in after Hudson Hawk. He says, no, some of his better movies came after it, Stefan says. A Pulp Fiction, 12 Monkeys, Fifth Element, Sixth Sense, Unbreakable. At least four of which are, you know, truly excellent films. He also asks, what exactly are the rules for the Film Club review? I think the first rule of Film Club is there are no rules. Isn't that right, David?
Indeed, yeah.
But he would
anything.
Even Hudson Hawk in this case. He is, though, a huge fan and sucker, says Stefan, for single-setting movies, like, you know, one location. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I like the idea of checking out Linklater's Tape, Polanski's Death and the Maiden, which is 85% single-setting, and then you have classics like 12 Angry Men and Das Boot. What do you think about that, Michael?
That's a pretty good subgenre. I'd add Lifeboat, the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Oh, I've not seen that.
That's a good one. And Rope as well.
Rope, clearly, yeah. To an extent, The Hateful Eight, although that does have significant portions outside, but I think one of the things that I love most about that film was the way that Tarantino uses that claustrophobic single set to his advantage. Dave, you got any single set?
Oh, God, you've caught me off guard here.
I'm
sort of racking my mind for good single set movies.
Buried. Ryan Reynolds classic.
Ryan Reynolds in a coffin.
What about a film that a lot of people really love and I've not actually seen? Is it Locke?
Oh, yeah. Hardy in a car.
Our good friend Ash Clark's all-time fave.
You're kidding.
Yeah, oh, God, it's he's quite besotted with that film.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, potentially that's a film club because it would tick a box for Ashley and also, by the sound of it, for Stefan. Coming on to that Last Jedi review any second. Quick shout-out, though, to Mark Millam, who was discussing on his school run the merits of letting kids see Pitch Perfect, the new one coming out in December. Don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I've not seen either of the picture.
I don't have any kids, so I wouldn't know whether that would be permissible or not.
But he also raises the question of favourite taglines and mentions the Alien Predator one. Whoever wins, we lose. We covered taglines extensively, Mark. I'm a little bit disappointed you weren't aware of that. In an early episode, maybe episode two or three.
I think this is a callback. He wants to be a part of that party.
Okay.
Why wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Well, listeners, if you have a favourite tagline, send it in. And maybe in our end of year special, which is going to be coming up and I think going to be featuring a pretty special guest.
Yeah, special guest alert.
Special guest alert. We can have a special tagline celebration. We can ask our special guest what his favourite tagline is.
I suspect he'll have some good ideas for that one.
All right.
I can't wait. Mm.
Do you have a favourite tagline, Michael?
I'd say it happened for Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh.
It's a .. it happened! Exclamation mark.
All right. It's an eclectic one. The Last Jedi, Rey and Ben, or Kylo Ren if you want to call him that, continue their journey into the Force with lightsabers. Here's Snoke having a chat with Kylo, his young apprentice.
When I found you,
well, there you go. It's been a long wait, but Monday, Michael, David, we crammed ourselves into an IMAX in Leicester Square and saw this, and we're going to review it now, which is, it's kind of a funny review, this one, because everyone's going to watch it anyway, I think. So
everyone's going to watch it and they don't want to know much beforehand.
Exactly.
So have we pitched this?
Let's be careful.
God, I think, like, you know, this is like fatwa level. If we spoiler here.
We were actually warned at the screening by no less a figure than BB-8 himself not to do any spoilers. But, of course, we wouldn't do that.
Of course not.
Not here at Little White Lies, Stroke Truth and Movies. Michael, what do you want to say within those parameters, then, about The Last Jedi?
Well, so this is episode 8, the sequel to Force Awakens, after Rogue One last year, which was a prequel. And this is the continuing adventures of Rey, Finn and Poe Dameron, the three new characters introduced in Force Awakens, as well as returning adventurers Luke and Leia.
Hmm.
And if you remember from Force Awakens, there's this shady First Order type empire, big bad, that's taken over and crushed the Republic. And now the last vestiges of the Republic are now the Resistance, led by General Leia Organa. And they're on the run.
Very nicely done. Central plank of the storyline centres on the convoy of remaining Resistance people drifting through space waiting for their fuel to run out. I felt that was a little bit of a bland storyline, but you do go on.
That's the structure around which... something that's interested me since these films have started coming out is what is the sort of this new trilogy, this new wave of Star Wars movies, what's the thing going to be? We know with Marvel it's going to be all these crossing over of heroes and characters and callbacks and call forwards. With this one, it seems that Star Wars is all about red herrings, it's all about fake outs, it's all about callbacks and then remixes and revisions of what you come to expect from Star Wars. A lot of people said that Force Awakens played almost like a beat by beat remake of A New Hope, episode 4. And this one, from the very beginning, I'd say, is playing with your expectations of what this film may be, if it's going to be The Empire Strikes Back of this new trilogy, for example.
And it does share strong elements of that.
Without being specific, yes, it does. By now I've come to treat, speaking with a touch of, with a touch of salt, I've come to treat those trailers with a bit of caution, because this is the third time out now where a trailer has given you what seems to be many new plot threads and thematic elements, and then maybe the film doesn't exactly play to play that way.
I like that.
There's a line in the trailer where it's Mark Hamill saying, this isn't going to go the way you think, and that seems to be the whole modus operandi of the way Rian Johnson's made this film.
Okay. Can I just leap in early and say, Mark Hamill was the nicest surprise of this film for me. He's always been regarded as the weak link, perhaps cast initially for his looks, which obviously then were changed dramatically by the car crash, and that for such a central figure in such an enormous saga, he wasn't the most powerful or the most charismatic of presences. But I thought in this film, I was really, really surprised and really impressed with his performance.
I would agree. I mean, watching this film, I had a kind of weird sort of my own sort of internal Rogue One side thought, in that I was thinking, isn't it a shame that Mark Hamill's career has, you know, post Star Wars was essentially kind of doing parodies of Star Wars and parodies of his characters
And
doing
video game voiceovers.
And video game voiceovers and things like that, and cartoons of Star Wars. Because of that iconic role, has, you know, is this kind of millstone around his neck almost. And, you know, no casting agent could be, think, we can't cast Luke Skywalker in our film. It would, you know, ruin it. And then you see him in this film, and he's this muscular thesp now, and you know, he actually does most of the kind of dramatic heavy lifting in the film and does it really well, and you kind of think, damn, that almost seems like a career, you know, hopefully it's a new chapter, you know, for him, but you kind of feel there's almost a kind of lost generation of Mark Hamill leading roles that could have been. Maybe I'm overstating it a little here, but you know.
Let's see. Maybe there'll be future roles for him within the Star Wars saga. We can't say at this point.
Oh, no.
But Michael, back to your thing, and we're heading towards the point when we discover, did it live up or did it disappoint?
So, with Star Wars, in a way, inhabits quite a unique position in our sort of movie-going diet.
Mm.
I saw it on Monday. I'm already booked in to see it two more times in the next 2 weeks,
right,
with friends and family, because it's become the Harry Potter or the Lord of the Rings now, where it's the thing you go and see a lot over Christmas. I need to see it again to know how I feel, because it hits some incredibly strong moments throughout, but it does feel a little bit bloated, overstuffed with characters. As I say, the sort of the feints and red herrings become a little bit sort of intellectual at times. It's 2.5 hours long. It's the longest Star Wars film by far.
Mm.
And I'd say within that, there are subplots that they're giving to some of the deeper members of the ensemble that could probably just be lifted out completely.
Mm.
But overall, oh gosh, there are some real moments, and Mark Hamill's kind of key scenes in particular are incredible, and he's top billed in this, so it's amazing to think that, you know,
he's Luke,
they're
he?
Not just embarrassed to bring him back because that's the connective tissue with the old films, they're proud to have him back.
Yeah, you mentioned the direct comparison with Empire,
mm,
and I think that's, it's kind of telling, because that's such a tight bit of storytelling, Empire Strikes Back, and it contains some of the most iconic moments, not just as a Star Wars saga, but of kind of popular movie culture. No, Luke, I am your father. Mm. I love you, I know. All that stuff. And there's nothing really in this, I think, that matches that. And I think there's two, for me, elements that I really felt missing in this one. One was Han Solo, and there's nothing you can do about that. But the other one was Lawrence Kasdan, who did co-write The Force Awakens, had written the storyline for this, which Rian Johnson basically said, oh, I'm not going to go with that, I'm going to go with my own storyline. So he's done his own, which I think was a really distracted, as you say, quite unnecessarily long. Mm. There's a whole section in the middle. I don't know if that was for Disney purposes, that he said, okay, you need this, 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 or you can have that bit, but it served no real purpose.
I don't know. I see what you're saying here, and, you know, I know I'm sort of on dangerous ground here in the terms of describing it, but yeah, there is a sense of, like, you expend a lot of energy thinking, why did we just see that? How did that sort of serve the greater purpose?
Mm.
And how does that fit into the story? How does that kind of add to the movie? And you know, I think that there is a kind of theme underlying the story overall. I'm not necessarily trying to justify these, but I'm just trying to say what my thoughts were. But like, this idea of, you have to keep plugging away, whatever the odds.
Mm.
You know, you can't just sort of rest on your laurels. You can't just sit back. This is all about kind of taking action, doing things, getting up. You know, any kind of last ditch attempt to kind of preserve the hope in the world. I mean, hope is the kind of term that is kind of mentioned almost every single scene.
It's the motif, isn't
it's
it?
It's the motif, indeed. Which is, you know, it's very very Star Warsian.
Indeed.
I think that the film does succeed in terms of its kind of key moments, the beats it has to hit.
Mm.
I think my problem is that it has probably a cast of 8 or 9 characters now, and it tries to give them all something to do. And even if that just involves running up and down a corridor for an hour, kind of barking orders. And it's a shame, because we were introduced to these characters in Force Awakens, you know, John Boyega and Adam Driver and Daisy Ridley, who are all really kind of, you know, commanded the screen, and they had a lot of charisma and charm. But in this one, they seem a little bit sidelined.
I don't think Rian Johnson knows what to do with some of the plot lines that he's inherited, given what he appears to have done with them in this film. But yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's hard to talk about without being specific. Mm. It may just seem that we're coming off as maybe more negative than we would otherwise.
Well, like many people, I really wanted to like this film. And for most of the film, I did. I would say, I need to watch it again. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to doing so because it's a Star Wars film. It's got some very good bits in it. It's got some very bad bits in it. There are two moments in this that are almost prequel level bad for me, that they are shark jumping. And one involves Princess Leia. The other one involves BB-8. Mm-hmm. And they significantly changed the way I felt about the film. I enjoyed it to start with. And then with Hamill and with the final kind of, how long did it take? 40 minutes or so on the
final set piece, yeah.
Yeah. That whole part there, for me, Johnson kind of gets it back under control and that makes it worthwhile. Mm. I really enjoyed that. But I was disappointed overall because of that middle section that just seemed like he didn't really know what he... And I'm, as I say, I'm not sure if maybe The Force Awakens, because Kazdan was involved, who's, you know, not only Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but also things like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm. But also maybe J.J. Abrams had enough clout to keep the storyline the way he wanted it. I'm not sure if maybe Disney, who are quite famous, are they not, for the way that they will manage what a director thinks he's doing or not doing with a storyline. I mean, maybe they got involved a bit much in this. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It's hard to sort of second guess that. There's this whole thing about the Han Solo movie and
Which Kazdan is working on.
Which Kazdan is working on. And if anything, that seems like the directors of that movie were moving it too far off-piste.
Right.
And that's why they brought Ron Howard in to steady the boat. So we'll see how that goes next May. But
and the same with Episode 9. They've booted Colin Trevorrow off the project.
And J.J. Abrams is back for that.
But it seems that Rian Johnson, they're actually happy with him because they've just announced this new trilogy that he's going to make. And I think off the back of this film, I'm very happy to see what that is because it is a tension within this movie. As I was saying, trying to figure out what this new trilogy is. And this trilogy is the tension between legacy and new stories within an old world and what needs to happen to let go of the past. And that's it. We are now seeing what this trilogy is going to look like, the sort of the shape and the characters and those overarching themes. And I actually can't wait to see what Rian Johnson can do completely, you know, unshackled from that.
Right.
One of the things I've sort of picked up on in the kind of early reviews that have been released is a lot of people talking about how emotional the film is.
Mm.
It's the most emotional Star Wars, which for me is not is faint praise maybe, but like, yeah, a lot of people are saying how kind of deep it is and how it sort of buries deep into the psyche of its characters and it deals with these kind of weighty humane themes and this idea of preserving the Republic and blah blah blah. But for me, on an emotional level, and I'm really a kind of sentimental guy when it comes to cinema. I mean, you know, like in a film like, for instance, Wonder, I was like, you know, this is. I know you weren't a fan, but I was actually quite, you know, smitten by some of it because you know, just very very sort of simple moments. And for me, this film really lacked these kind of very very sort of simple, pure, you know, almost like silent beats where you're kind of allowed to kind of soak in a moment.
It was interesting to watch this in conjunction this week with Mountains Made Apart, which is absolutely a movie which gives you a simple, very clear, utterly kind of emotionally true storyline. But yes. There is this emotional aspect which he's explored, the loneliness, if you like, of the force and the power that it brings, which I thought was an interesting element of this film. Michael,
it's interesting when you talk about this emotional aspect. It's just as much in the film as it is in the viewer. I found the moments that I was most strongly responding to were the moments that reminded me of watching the original films or playing the video games, a certain soundtrack cue. There's no other.
It's when a TIE fighter screams, you're kind of like, you're back there. But yeah, I think that might be the thing, is like, for me, Star Wars is meaningless. I have no connection to it.
And they're like, searching for meaning in this film.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of the really positive reviews are from people for whom Star Wars doesn't have that meaning. Because, I mean, certainly my experience of this is Star Wars ultimately, and I'm excluding the prequels from this, but it is a fable. I mean, it is the fable.
Mm.
And this, whilst it being a serviceable sci-fi film, is for the most part not fabulous. As I say, at the end, I think Rian Johnson gets it back. Even visually, there are the finer shots in this film all come in the final sequence. And a film which I thought had been a little visually bland compared to The Force Awakens, which had some just gorgeous sights in it. He kind of does come good in the end. But by and large, I didn't find this to have that same sense of fable. It wasn't fabulous in that sense. And it reminded me, again, what a great job J.J. Abrams had done with Force Awakens in terms of just bringing that whole thing back to life. I know a lot of people felt it was too similar to A New Hope, but...
I preferred Force Awakens.
Did you?
I definitely did. I thought it had a certain kind of charm and levity to it that
although there are some very funny moments in this.
Yeah, the humour in this really grated on me, got to say. And I think, you know, maybe we can sort of get to that when we talk about Brick, because I think that's, you know, his kind of, you know, kooky sense of humour is kind of ladled on a little bit thick here.
But it's a particularly kind of modern, self-aware sense of humour, which, you know, you're presented with Star Wars, which is so in keeping with the film's made 40 years ago. But then you suddenly have these sort of wacky one-liners and
almost kind of sitcom level kind of setups, and it's like
that's the one part that I think completely thuds for me, the sense of humour throughout.
So give it some scores then, David.
Well, I think I was excited for Rian Johnson, and I've really liked the last two. I really like Rogue One and Force Awakens. So I'd say a 4, just because I'm not a Star Wars head, and I just can't get excited about it on that level. Enjoyment was, even though I was probably mixed on it. I think the good outweighed the bad for me, and I would, you know. Although I probably wouldn't be running back to the cinema to see it, because for me it was maybe a tad too long. It felt like 2.5 hours. I'd probably say 4 as well, and maybe a 3 in retrospect.
Michael?
I think quite similar to David, I've enjoyed the other ones. I am a big Star Wars fan, but I did approach this one with a little bit of caution, just because how many, you know, we're going to see Star Wars films every year until we die now, and that's, I quite like Star Wars being a thing.
No, but I'm loving that.
Yeah. You know, anyway, so that was 4. But then enjoyment, yeah, I'm probably levelling out as a 4. I'm probably coming off as more negative than I am, because when you can't geek out about certain moments, you can only be general. And I'm looking forward to watching it again and maybe reassessing. So probably a 4 there as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say 5 for anticipation, which might be why my next 2 scores would be 3 and 3. But like you, I want to go back and see it again. Let's move on then. Slight change of pace here as we tackle Mountains Made Apart. All right, David Jenkins, Mountains Made Apart. What is it?
Well, it's a new film by the Chinese director Zha Jianke, who is kind of quite a name on the sort of festival/arthouse circuit. He makes these quite austere and critical films of China, about sort of modern China. He's someone who actually... It's very rare that his films will actually get past censorship laws in China, because they are kind of critical of the communist state and of decisions made by the government, mainly to do with kind of modernization and globalization. He's from a kind of northern Chinese mining town called Fengyang.
All right, where this one's set.
Where this one is set. And little bit of trivia here is that he owns a restaurant called Mountains Made Apart in Fengyang.
Okay, what does the title refer to? Is it a quotation from something, or
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. It's a weird one. It sounds like a sort of slight weird translation of a proverb or something.
Right. Is it something to do with the passage of time?
I guess so. I mean, I think it's probably a reference to this idea of, like, because I mean, all his films are about, you know, cities being uprooted and moving, like, along, you know, along rivers and to different sites. So it's this idea that, you know, people can constantly be uprooted. And even when you have these kind of, you know, you're connected to the landscape, there's still a way to be kind of moved elsewhere. I mean, and this film is more of a melodrama, you call it. I mean, it's a sort of romantic melodrama, that a kind of triptych narrative that takes place over 3 different time periods. It starts off with the actress Zhao Tao, who is... who actually is Zha Jianke's wife and muse. She's in pretty much all of his films, and I think she's one of the great living actors. She's astonishing in this film, and it starts off with her doing kind of line dancing to Pet Shop Boys' "Go West," to herald in the joys of the new millennium. But as it sort of transpires, things don't go well for her, as she enters into a kind of love triangle between a kind of slimy capitalist and a kind of guy who works in a coal mine, who she kind of has a sort of relationship with. And the film essentially follows her decision over 3 time zones, timelines, I guess, 3 chunks of time.
Excellent. Well, I mean, it's quite a long film. Mm. And I must admit, when I saw what we were doing this week, Star Wars, yay, a 2.25-hour Chinese film, I was a little bit more cautious about that, but I absolutely loved it.
Oh, glad to hear
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I thought it was brilliant. What did you think, Michael?
I was a little cooler on it, but I did like it. This is actually the first of his films I've seen. I've actually missed out on Touch of Sin and The World and previous ones in the past. This has taken a long time to come out here. It was in Cannes 2.5 years ago.
You're kidding.
2015.
And it was at the London Film Festival in 2015. It's just been one that people have been dying to come out in the cinema, and now it is. I really appreciated that ambition, the sort of these three time periods. If you want to say it's like the Before trilogy in one film, the original English Before trilogy, or it's a bit like Place Beyond the Pines in a way, following a family across a generation. And the little sort of cinematic tricks that he pulls, there's lots of interesting choices there, like the title card doesn't come up until 45 minutes in when you realise you're going from 1999 to 2014, and then later on you do go further into the future for a third act. And likewise, lots of sort of film nerd things like the changing of aspect ratios and cinema and camera setups for each period. I found that results varied across the film.
Right.
Really? I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I think that it's a common criticism of the film, actually, it's one that I kind of concur with, that there's a sequence later in the film where he transfers to Australia, where Zhao Tao's son has kind of decamped there to sort of start a new life embracing capitalism there. I think it's just one of those things where he doesn't seem comfortable filming in English language. Mm-hmm. The assured style of the first two chapters kind of is. It's one of those things, like, I don't know, you can't absorb yourself in the story because it's sort of like it's hindering you a bit, because you can see.
Well, one of the issues with that final bit is the fact that it barely involves, what's her name?
Zhao Tao.
I mean, it barely involves Zhao Tao, who is, I mean, extraordinary through the rest of the film, and then brings it back together at the end.
Yeah, that's really, really sort of problematic in that last section, that you kind of, the sort of emotional linchpin of the film is kind of shoved aside for maybe a little bit too long.
In a sense, it does illustrate a little bit what I think Zha Zhangkei is doing here, in that you might have something, that things move on. There is a river that flows through this film, both literally and metaphorically. And in a sense, what you may think of as the kind of central temple of the movie isn't necessarily going to remain the central temple of the story. Things move on. And actually, I saw a... something from, is it Manola Dargis in New York Times, who points to the river in its kind of central role, and points out specifically this triptych idea that in the film, characters go to the river, three characters the first time, two characters the second time, and then just one at the end. And it's neatly done.
Mm. Oh, God, I think there's probably tons and tons of stuff in the film that you'd have to sort of like watch again and sort of pore over to really sort of get out of it. I think it's so rich. And, I think that one of the things I like about him is that his films generally feel very kind of quite intuitive, and he gives moments time to breathe, and you sometimes you kind of left thinking this is a long take, or this scene is kind of going on for quite a long time. But actually, like, I think there's like, the more you think about it, there is a kind of immense precision to how he makes movies, and like, every detail feels very thought through in the end.
One thing about this film, the aging effects are brilliantly done. Astonishing. Which one is the real Zhao Tao?
I suppose maybe the middle section.
Is it the middle?
I presume, because I think they're supposed to be early 20s to begin with.
And then
towards the end, quite middle age, late middle age. Mm. I think it's interesting, David, you talk about genre and how he plays with genre across his movies. This being a romantic melodrama, I really did appreciate all those little details, the depth and the themes. There's a very good review of the film by Nick Pinkerton in the latest Sight and Sound, with all these kind of critics that can go deep and really pick apart the film. But on a moment-to-moment level, as a romantic drama, I didn't feel involved in the way that I would want to from a film like this.
Okay.
And maybe it is that sort of level of commentary and criticism in a film like this, where it's the loss of innocence, the passing of time, and so on, and the way that at the end that sort of nostalgia is very on the nose, a sort of loss of motherland and mother tongue, all in one character. It just felt very sort of overdetermined to me.
Really,
rather than wanting to just go along with be whisked away by these feelings.
All right. I mean, I've often been the wrong end of a love triangle, so I really did feel it keenly. Right, OK. David, anything else? Would you like to give it numbers?
I'd probably give it 4s across the board. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought it was a really, really great film. I'm really excited by when he has a new film coming out, and I think he's currently working on a martial arts movie, which I'm very excited about.
Wow.
I think it's the last chapter for me that sort of, you know, maybe nudges it down a notch. Although I would still like to see it again and try and find a way of justifying how that fits into the story at large. It'd be a bit more of a sort of seamless fashion, I guess.
Michael?
I'd say 4. You know, as one of those great auteurs of the festival circuit, I was looking forward to watching this. But then probably 3 and 3, really. Mm. I'm willing to go and do all the necessary reading and maybe watch it again down the line, and maybe my opinion will change, but it didn't seem to...
If you want to go full on and see his kind of like most... toughest, difficult, but I think maybe best film, he did this film called Platform, right. And it's like a kind of... It's his version of a musical. It's like... following a kind of band during the Cultural Revolution, and it's them sort of touring around like small villages in China, and there's no story. It's just kind of going around, and you see what's happening in the country, and it's just kind of incredible. Yeah, it's 3 hours long.
Just from a cultural point of view, I that's one of the things that made the film interesting for me, even though. It is quite a long film in which not that much happens on a moment-to-moment basis, although there are big changes story-wise. It was just that whole kind of window on what seemed to be kind of ordinary Chinese life, provincial Chinese life. I'm going to say Anticipation 2, because, you know, which might be why I enjoyed it so much. I think, yeah, 4 and 4. Yeah. All right, then.
Great. Jia Zhangke convert.
Yeah. There we go.
We're winning the war.
next up, we're looking back on Rian Johnson's debut film, Brick.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I really screwed up.
Screwed up how?
The brick.
What?
I didn't know it was bad, but the pin's on it now. You gotta help me.
Slow down now. This isn't good.
No.
Emily said words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch.
Brick? No.
Tug?
Tug might be a drink, like milk and vodka.
Pin? You know the kingpin. Dope robber, right?
Big time. What are you gonna do?
She asked for my help. I just wanna know she's okay.
So what's first?
I'm gonna start shaking things up.
Yep, Film Club this week in celebration of Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi, digging up his debut film, Brick. Mm-hmm. Which did he invent a new genre with this, David? High school noir?
Well, I mean, it reminds me of a bit of Bugsy Malone.
Bugsy Malone.
I think that's probably the closest that you can get to it. But
Alan Parker's Bugsy Malone, of course.
Indeed.
Yeah. What happened to Alan Parker? Is he still making
he's
films?
Still around? He did he did an anniversary, 40th anniversary Bugsy Malone thing.
Did he?
BFI recently last year.
Didn't he do Far From the Madding Crowd recently? Oh, no, not Far From the Madding Crowd. Tale of Two Cities.
Did
or a Dickens adaptation with Ralph Fiennes. Maybe that wasn't him. So I'm getting people confused here.
No worries.
Dexter Fletcher's around, though. Hmm? He's in Bugsy Malone. He's Babyface, Dexter Fletcher.
He's Dexter Fletcher in Bugsy Malone. Yeah. Good knowledge. But Brick. Right, yes. Okay. what did listeners make of this?
So this is Cam Brick. All caps, 3 exclamation marks. Nice. Great choice. Revisited it a couple of months ago, first time in years. It really held up surprisingly well. And I was concerned in retrospect, it would just turn out to be an R-rated feature-length OC episode. It wasn't. It flowed and intrigued, and the young cast generally impressed.
Chris Henry, perfect in almost every way.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
But the real gem here is a screenplay, 40s noir in a nondescript high school. The names are so right, Tug, The Pin, etc. Brilliant stuff. Paul Bacardi, not only seen it, I bought special edition DVD with a frame of the original movie and a short story written by Rian Johnson.
All right, which he's made available because he did the novella first of this, and he's made all that available on his website, which apparently is a treasure trove of free stuff and giveaways.
I need to go on there. Yeah.
Stuart Simpson, one of the best films made this century. Ooh. It's one of those films you want to watch again straight after you watch it.
Right, but you might have problems doing that unless you own a copy. As Wayne Edge points out, where can I get Brick online for this week's film club? I do apologise, because to our enormous surprise, it's not available on any of the kind of mainstream streaming services.
I think it's been lost because the DVD I have is an Optimum DVD, which was a label a few years ago that went out of business and was acquired by Studio Canal, and there are some things that have fallen in between the cracks.
Right.
I suspect, though, as usually happens with these things, that it will come out in a deluxe edition when Star Wars reaches home ends, because they'll want to kind of, you know, someone will have picked it up and picked up his catalogue and want to do something. You know, Rian Johnson box sets will be all the rage.
Yeah.
You'll probably not be able to not see it soon.
True. Yeah.
Any other comments, Michael?
Ian Harris, a truly brilliant yet highly underrated modern film noir. Gordon Levitt gave us a taste of how great he would be in the future with this role too.
Dave Tulloch left me at the time confused and disappointed. Have to go back and review it.
Does he go back and review it?
He does. We'll have to find out.
Oh, that was
Dave
kind
Tulloch,
of the point.
Let us know if you did. Theo Leeds didn't get it, quote unquote, the first time, but now sits happily in my top films I didn't get, but now love.
Oh, right. Well, there that's a great category, isn't it? Yeah. Great films you didn't get, but now love. Would you like to have a bang on that? I've got one straight away. Monsters, Inc. Unbelievably, I didn't like Monsters, Inc. the first time I saw it, which means that you cannot take seriously anything I say here in this podcast.
My ultimate turnaround, going from absolute, like, I thought this was the pits, absolute the worst, to thinking I think it's the best, is the film Death Proof by Quentin Tarantino.
Which I've not seen.
The Grindhouse movie, yeah.
When I saw it in Cannes originally, I was just like outraged that someone could do a film that doesn't have an ending, or there's no kind of point to it. And I think when Django Unchained was coming out, I decided to sort of do a bit of a QT, you know, back watch. And that film, I was just like jawed to the floor, like, how wrong have I been?
Wow.
Death Proof, I think.
I just thought of another one for me. And again, people are going to be, what? Hot Fuzz. Didn't like it when it came out. Thought it was wildly overrated. Have seen it many, many times due to one member of my family being a big fan. And I absolutely love it now, which is could have an interesting thing on our special guest for Christmas.
I'm with you on that. I think I liked it the first time, but then rewatched it recently and I'll send you my little piece I've written about it recently on how it's the ultimate Brexit movie.
Oh. I've actually read that.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
you
don't need to
say
it.
You can read it again.
All right. I'll see if I think the same thing the second time.
Yes.
Michael, anything else on Brick?
So there are a couple of good ones here. Scott Campbell says Brick is an absolutely dreadful movie.
Right. Does he say why?
No, I don't think we can be friends. I love this
movie.
You
love this movie,
This was a movie I saw first year of university, just as I was coming into my own as like loving films and finding out about noir.
What did you study at university?
English.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it did well for me. I was obsessed, got the DVD, got the soundtrack. I love the soundtrack. This film is made by Ryan Johnson's cousin, kind of lots of found, you know, kind of instruments and self-made instruments, Perret piano and so on. And it's rewatching it the other week. It's exactly the same. Absolutely perfect movie, the way it maps those film noir tropes over the high school setting.
Mm.
I've got to say, on that note before, I was actually, when I first saw it in the cinema, when it came out, I don't remember, like, going nuts for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, wouldn't have bothered my kind of films of the year. But then actually rewatching it recently, this is just really impressive. And I actually think with the time that's passed, it actually looks like a more impressive feat than it may have done when it happened. Like, maybe, I think at the time, I think I might have dismissed it as a bit of a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, he's just sort of, you know, fusing these two things together for the sake of it. But actually, like, the fact that nobody has really done anything like it since with such immaculate results. I mean, you know, it's, you know, I think the tone, he just nails the tone of it so well. It's not just like people parroting like this kind of, you know, awful hackneyed noir dialogue. It's there is actually a proper story and proper emotions to it.
How do you feel about his second film, Looper?
That's his third film.
Oh, what was his second film?
The Brothers Bloom.
I love The Brothers Bloom.
No.
That was him.
Someone loves The Brothers Bloom.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it with Rachel Weisz and who else is in it?
Adrian Brody.
Mark Ruffalo.
Right.
That film.
Is it really bad? Ooh. Michael?
I remember quite liking it. It was a long time ago. I remember there's Rinko Kikuchi's really good at
it. It's a caper.
It is a caper.
Yeah, they go to nice locations and stuff. Wow, sorry. Okay, so that was his second film. What did you make of his third film then?
Looper, I think, is really good as well.
I didn't like Looper. I started out really liking it, and then it does. There's a massive plot hole, and it never recovers.
It's a bold film, I'd say. Mm. I mean, and I think with Looper, it's like you're either going to think that the switcheroo it does in the middle is a really kind of bold and interesting move, or you're going to think, oh, I really love that thing it was doing at the beginning. I wish it did that some more. So
I think it's time to rewatch that. It's certainly a film for a certain type of person. My uncle and my cousin watched it, and the next morning my cousin came down and my uncle had charted out the entire plot as a diagram on the kitchen table.
Sounds an interesting man.
Like, I think he'd become a bit loopy himself.
I mean, it's interesting looking at his films, look at his previous films, and sort of with the knowledge of having seen Star Wars, because I think there is so much in there that you can kind of project onto the sort of Star Wars galaxy. I mean, like in Brick, for instance, the Lucas Haas character, the Pin, who is a kind of he's a drug dealer who works out of his mother's basement and wears this kind of long black cowl and has this very, very kind of scary, what do you call it?
Like a cane.
He's sort of set up as this kind of, you know, drug kingpin, but there is something quite sort of tragic about the fact that he's having these kind of confabs with his, like, cronies while the mom is making them, like, cornflakes and stuff. And you think, and I think that's maybe an example of Ryan Johnson's quirky humour coming in, but there it really works, and you absolutely can see kind of a Kylo Ren, the Pin crossover. I mean, they're sort of, you know, slightly adolescent characters who, you know, or characters who are sort of on the cusp of adulthood, but still have these kind of, you know, attachments to their kind of youth and family, I guess, and obviously the little kid in you know. Maybe there's not a literal connection to it, but the sort of the chosen one kid in Looper, it feels like it should be something from Star Wars, even if it's not. Maybe I don't know enough about Star Wars to make that connection literally, but again, I don't want to compare, but like rewatching Brick, one of the things that I found really impressive about it is it's so much more than just like style. I mean, it's not and form. I think the best noir films have a kind of, there's a sort of tragic reason for why the kind of detective is doing what he's doing, and you know, like in films like The Maltese Falcon and even like something like Casablanca or The Long Goodbye, there is a kind of tragic element. Like, although the main character is this kind of street savvy hipster who is like, you know, landing one-liners on all these cronies and managing to get out of all these scrapes, there is a sort of like, the, you know, they're sort of doing it for love or something. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, there's a reason for that. They're sort of doing all this stuff. Even a film like Inherent Vice recently, mm-hmm. there's something quite sort of lovely about the fact that, you know, he's going through all these, you know, doing all this stuff because he's just in love with this woman. And I think it's a similar thing with Brick, that it's this very sweet kind of, you know, he's putting his life on the line constantly just because he wants to find out who killed this woman that he loved. Yeah. So
I love it, watching it now almost as a social document as well, because it's that sort of hinterland between Generation X and what we'd see as the modern day sort of digital hipster kind of teenager.
Mm.
There's one mobile phone in the entire movie. And it's, you know, he has to borrow the mobile phone, and it's the clothes, the sort of the everything, the sort of analog teenager.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because there's actually there are apparently loads of shots of shoes in the film
and birds
and shoes and birds. Yeah, mm. And I love this idea of like you can just tell a character from their shoes.
Yeah, mm. Really, and like, important.
And that is so amazing. I think that, you know, you could do something like filming and not someone's face, mm-hmm. Just instantly knowing who this person is. Like, I mean, you know who Brendan Fry is from his kind of like scruggy brown unlaced shoes. You know, it's like, yeah, no, it's very, very.
But it's also,
just looking at your shoes.
Oh yeah, no, I'm.
Yeah. Wow, David.
But that's like, it shows the economy of the filmmaking as well. This, it seems like one of the last of the 90s independent movies in a way. Mm. It's shot on film. You know, it's a certain budget level, which you wouldn't really get now. It's like a few hundred thousand dollars. But then...
Just, really?
Yeah. I think mostly raised by himself and his family.
Wow.
And shot in his hometown at his high school. It feels almost like the last gasp of a certain type of filmmaking.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, the first step of a pretty big career so far.
Yeah.
All right.
I hope he does us another Brick. Mm. It may be in between his sort of Galaxy Far, Far Away stuff.
That he could be a Nolan in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I'd really like him to be a kind of one for us and one for them kind of director. I'm sort of fingers crossed for that.
Brothers Bloom 2.
No. Please.
Fingers crossed, eh? All right. Next week on Film Club, what are we doing, David?
Well, we had a lovely little discussion about this ahead of the chat, and
so the films we're reviewing are The Greatest Showman,
yeah,
which I know nothing about, Molly's Game, which I know nothing about, except it's got gambling in it. Is that
right?
Yeah,
it's Jessica Chastain as a gambler, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin.
Oh right, okay.
And
Idris Elba's in it.
And Idris Elba's in it as well.
Yeah.
And whoa there, and then Last Showman is the kind of musical comedy of the life of P.T. Barnum.
Oh right, okay.
With Hugh Jackman.
I was just going to say, does it have Hugh Jackman in? Of course it.
Of course.
Right,
it has to.
I think we decided on looking at, I think this idea of gambling in movies is kind of interesting, and we've gone for a Jimbo fave.
Yeah, well, it's a.
If you want to maybe announce it.
Okay, so this is a film that I remember at the time being really struck by, firstly because it's a very singular way of certainly scripting a film. It's David Mamet, who's got his own voice. It's quite a monotone voice, but it's no less interesting for all that. And this is House of Games, which I caught back in the 80s and recently rewatched, and I still think it's a really interesting film. It's got Joe Mantegna in it. I can't remember who else is in it, but I loved this film when it came out. Still think it's really interesting. You guys have seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Right, David? You?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's available on things like iTunes and that.
It has got that kind of in 80s indie feel to it.
Mm.
It's, you know, like it feels of a piece with a film like Blood Simple, you know, like a really well-plotted, like, tête-à-tête between a small group of characters, you know, sort of who are kind of all out for each other.
Yeah.
And there's some gambling in the background.
There certainly is. There certainly is.
Now, look back over my shoulder. Guy in a beard and a cowboy shirt. You see him?
Yes.
He's from Las Vegas. He's been beating me all night. He's got to tell, okay? When he's bluffing, okay, he plays with his little gold ring. And I caught him doing it. And he knows I did, so he stopped. He's conscious of himself. I want you to do me this favor.
What's that?
I want you to be my girlfriend for a while. Come in the game. You stand behind me. Watch me play. We get in a big hand. I go to go pee. You watch this guy and tell me, does he play with his gold ring? Then I know he's bluffing. I win the big hand. And I forget the 800 your friend owes.
All right, so that's coming up next week. Oh, we've also doing Jumanji, it says here. Are we?
Oh, gosh. I think we might be switching one of either Jumanji or a Greatest Showman.
Okay.
We're gonna of course, have to make Jumanji. That decision depending on what we can see.
Right, okay.
But, yeah.
Jackman v. Johnson.
Yes.
Wow. Between a rock and a... Yeah. good. Well, anyway, listen, if you have seen House of Games, or when you have and want to let us know what you think about it, you can do so via email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Twitter is at LWLies. There's the Facebook page as well. Anything else you want to mention?
Oh, one thing I would like to give a shout out to, something to look out for next year. Last weekend, I was immensely privileged to see a preview of World of Tomorrow 2, The Burden of Other People's Thoughts, which the new Don Hertzfeldt animated short, which is, he makes these, you know, David, you're a fan of his films, he makes these incredible short animated films that are packed with ideas and feelings and innovation, and it was incredible. I'd look out for World of Tomorrow 2.
The first one is just bonkers and
it's
brilliant.
It's on Vimeo, you can see it
there.
It's
all done with stick men as well, to be
it's
added.
Very sort of specific animation, but
you have to pay for it, don't you?
He sells the first one on his Vimeo store.
Right, the second one?
The second one, who knows, it's premiering, well, wide at Sundance next year.
Okay.
But then also his film, It's Such a Beautiful Day, is on Netflix, I believe.
Okay.
Which is not a sci-fi film, it's more realistic.
Is that with like live action actors and stuff?
No, it's still stick men.
It's an hour long animation, but it's like, it's basically like The Tree of Life, but with animated stickmen.
And with just the most melancholy, poetic, beautiful, hilarious, sad tone of voice.
Yeah. Right. Good. All right, David, anything you want to add? A little coda?
No. I've just got to go back and finish off the magazine.
Right.
So I'm off to do that.
Well, we won't hold you up. Or you listeners, thanks for being with us. If you like, we'll be back again next week talking about some, if not all, of those films. In the meantime, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.